must have a code that you can live by, and so become yourself, because the past is just a goodbye. Teach your children well, their father's hell did slowly go by, and feed them on your dreams.
In this June 2015 edition of Education Now, we welcome the return of Scott Boltman to discuss the history of kindergarten from Froebel to modern day. Welcome back, Scott.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's such a pleasure. I'm very excited about this project. First, for those of who may be unfamiliar with Froebel, tell us about him.
Well, Froebel was born in the late 1700s in Germany, sort of southeastern Germany near the Czech border, and he was probably a gifted child. He had an interesting childhood, but he ended up apprenticed off to a forester when he was younger. Spent a lot of time in nature before he went to university. Studied architecture, fought in the war against Napoleon, and then his older brother died, and he took control of his two nephews, and then went to work with Pestalozzi in Switzerland. So that's where he became an educator, and he took all of the experience that had happened before and applied it to education. And what we know Froebel for today is that he invented kindergarten. He invented early childhood education, play-based education, child-centered education, a lot of things that we think of today as being, you know, recent developments all came from Froebel about 200 years ago.
Yes, they did. And I just can't believe how many people don't know that. And that's why it's such a great pleasure for me to do this interview, because how people can somehow get to be teachers and not have this information. Or for me, it's more like unions. Why weren't you out there fighting when they first started to abuse childhood? And so it's really a pleasure to have you here. If this project of yours gets the attention of the average person, you were saying in your blurb about a video about the Kickstarter, they'll have an opportunity to better understand the historical context of the current educational environment, i.e. testing, why so many people are homeschooling, and the Common Core. So really everything that you are doing and everything that we're doing in most public education with kindergarten and first grade, really for many even preschool, is damaging to the child.
Yeah, and it didn't happen all at once. And I think that's really, you know, whenever you have a situation where there's a lot of emotion, and when you're dealing with people's children and their education, there's always a lot of emotion. Right now we're taking five-year-olds, we're giving them standardized tests, and we're telling the teacher that your job depends on the results of those tests, because we're going to value you as a teacher, as a human being, based on these tests. And, you know, and it just doesn't seem right. But when you step back and look 100 years or so as to where that was, smack dab in the middle of the Froebel kindergarten movement. So Froebel started about 1817, and by about 1917, we were pretty much done with Froebel, and there were very specific reasons for it, and those reasons haven't changed today. And if you would have told the people, and it was John Dewey and Patti Smith Hill and the Columbia Teachers College, if you would have told them 100 years ago where we would end up in 2015, they would be horrified. But they made the best decision they could at the time, and it was a very gradual process. It took many generations to get to where we're at right now, and I liken it to the food situation, because if you look at, you know, if you go back, say, to the 1950s, you look at McDonald's, you know, he was setting out to make these restaurants where you could go and have a burger, and it was a fun place to hang out and have some soda pop. And, you know, if you would have told him then that, you know, in 2015, that people would be making so little money that they were having to feed their family with 99-cent meals, and that in order to offer a 99-cent meal, the genetically modified crops with lots of pesticides and hormones and beef, and meant that this agriculture was... Well, but anyway, so this process took a long time, and the system really degraded over time. And I think the people who are involved in it all are well-meaning to a degree, but they don't have enough context, historical context, to understand how and why we got here. And a lot of times with the in academia, with the teacher trainers at the university level, they don't have access to this research. A lot of this these books and periodicals were purged from libraries, including the NEA library, because they simply don't have room to store it all. And since it's so old and it's been so long since people have wanted to access that information, they just simply discarded it. Mm-hmm. And so it's ended up on the market. And what I did was, in my research, I didn't have the time or the budget to go traveling all over the country. So I simply acquired all of this stuff as it was being discarded from these university libraries. And so I've been able to rebuild a large archive. And now I'm in a process where I have a film project that I think can tell the story very succinctly to give people that perspective that they need to understand how and why we got here.
Yes. And that's this Kickstarter project, right?
Yes. Yes. And so what we're trying to do is it's a threefold project, because it's a very small budget, essentially just enough to capture the interviews that we need to have for a longer film. So we feel that for the budget that we're doing the Kickstarter film, we will accomplish three things. We will preserve these expert interviews, and a lot of the people that I would have liked to have interviewed have passed away over the last 5 or 6 years. And so I really feel there's an urgency to do this now while we still have people with this experience. The second thing is that we will create a brief overview, a 15-minute film that kind of tells you the history in a short, like a Cliff Notes version of it. And that will be useful for these university educators when they're training teachers, to give those teachers the perspective that they need without having to sit through like a 3-hour film or a 4-hour film. And then more importantly is, once we have a 15-minute film, we have a tool that most documentarians use to get fun pitch video. And its purpose is that there are lots of foundations.
Well, I wanted to back up a little bit. First of all, I want to say that I feel like our university teacher training programs do include the research about the importance of play and movement, and that is why Finland schools are so great, because as they will tell you, they came to this country and learned everything they needed to know in order for their schools to now be thought of as number one in 2011, and now at least in the top five, because they learned it all from us here in America. So it was intentional. I'm sorry to disagree with you, Scott, but I remember my father in the 50s reading to me about McDonald's and how he was so disgusted. And how, and what the projection was. And it is exactly what it is now. And now people who are employed by McDonald's are on welfare because they can't make a living working there. And of course, it mirrors
the teachers. You know, a lot of teachers, you compared it to Finland, for instance. So in Finland, if you want to become a teacher, it's about the same difficulty as becoming a doctor.
That's right.
And the pay is comparable.
Yes.
And if you want to become a teacher trainer, it's actually more difficult than becoming a university medical professor.
Right.
And the Finland early childhood system is based on Froebel. You're correct that they did. You could say they got it from us, or they basically got it at the same time that we got our Froebel basis. But what happened was that with these smaller countries, South Korea would be one. It's also high up.
Yes.
Singapore, Taiwan. They're technically much, much smaller countries. They're not quite as diverse as the United States is either. And so I don't vilify the administrators or the local governments, but you know, they have a much harder job here in the U.S. trying to manage and to measure education than they do in Finland. So Finland's been able to stay on a Froebel standard for their early childhood because they have a much smaller demand.
Frankly. Yes, they do. But I've read and listened to a great deal of information, and it's perfectly clear to me that they do not know what's wrong with this country because they learned it all here. And I'm sorry, but I saw what happened here in California. In when I moved to California to go to graduate school, it was because we knew we wanted to have children. And at that time, California was second only to New York in the nation for education. We are 47th now. And when Mr. Reagan got into office, he destroyed public education. It was free. University was free. It was a fantastic, beautiful model, and it was destroyed except in affluent communities where the local people have control and didn't bite into it, then and keep their property taxes going to education, they are flourishing. But for the majority of this country, they are at the mercy of these testing companies who own the textbook companies,
sure,
who are now milking public education with these tests and abuse and the abuse of children. There is so much research out there at Oregon in Eugene. They have done all this to prove Froebel was right. There is neurological proof that this is right on.
Piaget provided evidence, you know, for that, and it's you know, only gotten better since the 1980s, since our brain research has gotten more focused. And so, but it's an amazing analogy. I use the food analogy a lot because you look at the corporate farming, the impact on the nature from all this type of farming, and it's the same thing with teaching. There was such a huge demand 100 years ago for kindergarten. Everybody, once they saw the benefits of early childhood, everybody wanted it. They wanted to put it in the public schools. That meant it had to be managed by the public schools. And so you see people now with the homeschooling movement and the charter school movement, everybody's trying to pull back from the public schools. And it's really unfortunate because they're not recognizing that there was a reason why we all pooled our resources to do this. It's the same reason that we're not all going to start growing our own food in our own gardens. You know, not everybody is going to be able to homeschool their children. It sounds nice. And those people that are able to do it, more power to them. But unfortunately, our population is so large now that we're forced, we must have the discussion about public education. And so while I support charter schools, I support homeschooling, unschooling, and all of that, you know, it's really, like you said, for a lot for the affluent. You know, I was able to send my children to Montessori. And I really wish everybody would have that ability. And in Grand Rapids here, we're very fortunate. We have public school Montessori from infant toddler all the way up through high school.
Yes.
We're one of three or maybe four communities in the country that have that. But not everybody can get their child into even the public school Montessori program. There's a lottery, you know, and so it's not the way that we would want to be able to offer education. But we have 320 million people living here in the United States, and that's way more than what happens in Finland. So I admire what they do there. I admire the results of what they do. But it's not a comparable situation. We cannot just simply apply the exact same model as they do in Finland. But
we could if we thought in terms of each state instead of, you know, if the local people in each county had control. Then it would be small, and it would
there would be more localized management. But see, that's the key. What I was able to sort of give you give away the ending, I suppose. what I determined was that John Dewey and others were looking at this escalating demand for early childhood, and they recognized that what made Froebel education work so well was that the teachers were trained so highly. They weren't there to deliver curriculum. They were there to work with the child. It was child development. They followed the child.
That's right.
Right. And so that training was absolutely critical in order to do that. And so somebody, and I don't know who exactly at this point, but there was a group of these educators that decided that maybe to better train and manage these teachers, that they would provide this curriculum and that they could then standardize education throughout the country. But you can't standardize education when every child is unique. You can't.
That's right. No.
So the premise was flawed from the very beginning, but they were able to achieve some success. And why were they able to achieve success? Because they'd already been trained, and they were mentoring the younger teachers. And so for generation after generation, there was still enough quality in the system that they were able to tolerate and accept this top-down management using curriculum until maybe the 60s and the 70s, when enough generations had gone by that they simply couldn't. It's the same situation now with the food supply. You know, we were able to tolerate a little bit of pesticides. We were able to tolerate a little bit of GMO. We were able to tolerate a little bit of hormones in the beef and everything else. But now that the health epidemic that's happening right now, our food supply has gotten so corrupted that it's really causing us all to be sick. And the same is true with the education system. We've lost so much quality in there, and we're paying our teachers so little that the best teachers are now able to go. We had a teacher in my children's school who was offered, you know, a six-figure salary to come to New York City and teach in a private school. And of course, he made the jump immediately. Why would he stay here and make, you know, half or a third of that when he could go to New York? I know it's a higher cost of living there, but, I mean, it's... So the better teachers are going to the affluent schools.
Or they're leaving.
Well, everywhere. And that was the original problem was, how do you manage...
Yeah, how do you manage?
Yeah, so how do you manage and how do you measure? That's really ultimately now the question. And what I'm not seeing is I'm not seeing the people that are in that arena considering any other options than curriculum and standardized testing. They really feel like we need more of the same that's corrupted our education system, and that somehow will eventually... It's like GMO. It's like somehow genetically modified food will eventually be the salvation for our corrupted food system. It's not going to be. More pesticides are not going to be the answer. And more curriculum and more top-down management and more standardized testing is not going to help education. But we don't really realize that we had a better preschool method 100 years ago than we do today. You know, I was just on LinkedIn. There was a early childhood forum, and they were all talking about child-directed learning, whole child, child-centered, play-based, as though they were something that came up within the last two or three decades. And they're not. They're almost 200-year-old.
Yeah, I know.
Including, like, multiple intelligences, all sorts of stuff. We sort of feel like we invented them when really all we did was rediscover
right.
them.
Right, yeah, yeah, they're reinvented. Like, oh, look what we reinvented the wheel. And this is news to me, and it's just staggering. It's staggering, the ignorance.
Well, the positive thing, and I think this is, again, I could be negative about all of this. I could say, look at this terrible thing that was done 100 years ago or whatever. But the positive thing is that every good teacher, every generation of teachers rediscovers what they know to be the right way, that they need to teach in this way. They need to follow the child. You know, all of these things keep coming up. And so that's the good news. The good news is that we're not going to lose this message that Froebel gave us 200 years ago. We're going to keep rediscovering it, but we're not going to be able to support those teachers in the way that they know that they should be teaching if we don't recognize that the problem from 100 years ago, the one that John Dewey and the Columbia Teachers College and Patti Smith Hill and all those people were hoping to solve, is we have to find a way to recruit and train and manage and measure teachers in a completely different way than we're doing today.
Yes, well, I don't know. I understand where you're coming from, and I certainly do not want to be negative. But I do feel like it's a more cynical, that people like Bill Gates who really knows absolutely nothing about child growth and development, is being offered a microphone by huge media, by National Public Radio, the People's Radio, by PBS, by newspapers that should be going to experts. They should be coming to you before him. I mean, at least you have research. At least you have degrees. At least you know, what does he have? He has hardware.
I understand. And I feel the same passion and the same disappointment that you do. It's not, I can get negative, but there is really light at the end of the tunnel. I mean, to use the Bill Gates situation too, we were all forced to use DOS for a very long time, and then along came Apple, and we got the graphical interface, and then Bill Gates woke up and realized he needed to do Windows, and then Steve Jobs again realized that we were all going to be computing on our phones and developed, the iPod and the iPhone, and so, he's going to try his thing, and that's really what happened 100 years ago was that was right around the time when Henry Ford and a lot of this large industry from our Industrial Revolution was working on a lot of these management principles, and they thought, well, let's apply this to teaching. Let's apply these industrial processes to education, more of an art form. I mean, for Froebel, education was a spiritual calling. That our job as teachers was that every child had a spark of divinity. That's what he called it. And that our job was to nurture that and to try to help children to reach their full potential. And then what we did was, because we wanted to mass produce education, we developed this assembly line process and we brought in workers, right? They were not respected. Teachers were not respected as the craftsmen, as the artisans that they are. In the moment, the teacher has to decide, how do I work with this child? How do I reach this child? So one of the things that we will bring out in the documentary is that one of the largest supporters of Froebel in this country was Helen Keller. And the reason why Helen Keller was such a major supporter is because the reason why Ann Sullivan was able to reach her was because Ann Sullivan was a Froebel-trained teacher. Ann Sullivan was considered legally blind. She was...
I know.
Yeah. So people don't recognize that there's a training that you can have that will allow you to reach children like Helen Keller.
Right.
Just imagine what would happen to Helen Keller in today's world. She wouldn't be given somebody like Annie Sullivan to work with her. Unless your parents were wealthy, and the Keller family was well off.
That's right.
But my point is that back then, all early childhood teachers were Froebel-trained teachers.
Yes.
And so they were able to reach all sorts of children. And today, the children are measured, and they decided, oh, these children are going to go to college. These are going to be, they need to have a technical training.
Right.
And so another message that comes out in the documentary is that, right now, the leaders in industry, companies like Apple and Google, they know that the future of our economy is in creativity. But the management systems that have been governing education for the last 40, 50 years have been systematically removing art and music and athletics.
Right.
And all these things that provide such, and so the people that run Google, they had Montessori education.
Yes, that's right, they did.
And so, but the question is, and what people are struggling with, and why I think a lot of well-meaning, well-off people have thought to go the charter school route, is they do recognize that maybe the public schools are not as well-run as they need to be, and maybe some better management team can do a better job. But what we found with charter schools is that two things occur. Number one, they take valuable resources away from our public school system. They essentially cripple our public schools. And at the same time, the management processes that they put in place are often worse. It's not the right kind of management system. And so we're not really solving the problem. We're just actually making it worse.
Yes, so I think the biggest problem with charters is that there are these great charter schools that are started by parents and teachers, because they want it to be child-centered. And those are pretty good charter schools. I've visited. And then there are these chain charter schools that are started by people who have a business model in mind of how that ADA that, you know, that they get per pupil. That's what they're looking at. That's their bottom line. And so they pack it up, and their interest is in the test scores. And they even lie about it. And so these chains are the ones that are being supported by the testing companies and the textbook companies. All of them who, you know, really, this is affecting not your kids and my grandchildren. No, this is affecting people in poverty. This is who this is affecting. And so I don't know if this message is going to get through. They're also getting the poorly trained teachers, the Teach for America teachers that Bill Gates is so proud of. These teachers that have not been through the teacher training process that I think is really good, but they have just been plucked out of their particular, you're majoring in this and you want to make some money for a while till you decide what you want to do. Oh, come and teach for us. You see, it's not really teachers. I know so many incredible teachers that do know this. The majority know this. They're not allowed. And I'll tell you something, even in the good charter schools, they have to do that testing to get their money. And that is a disgusting. I mean, if you're going to call it a Montessori or a Waldorf charter school, then you better be following the child, and if you do that, then you're not testing. And so I have that, you know, I have that problem with it, you know, how they can't really do this alternative that we've known for over 100 years is the best thing for children, with children in poverty or people who try to start their own thing, because, you know, that, you know, at least here in California, our governor doesn't like the tests. So, you know, there's hope. But in so many places,
if the system was effective, everybody would be happy with the results. And they're doubling down on this standardized testing. They're doubling down on this curriculum. And they're thinking it's, again, it's like this fast food situation with McDonald's. McDonald's is, their sales are declining, and they have been declining. And so they're not waking up and realizing that people don't want to eat food that is not...
They don't want to eat plastic.
So they keep asking themselves, maybe we should get into pizza, maybe we should get into ribs, maybe we should, you know, right? So they're asking themselves the wrong question. They know that they have a problem. We all know there's a problem with public schools, but what they keep saying is, well, maybe we have the wrong curriculum. Maybe we need to go to the Common Core. So they keep analyzing the wrong part of the problem, and they think it's a different curriculum. Maybe we need to train teachers differently. Maybe we need to have a different management, you know, in there with the charter school instead of the public school, you know. And so they keep asking themselves the wrong part of the problem, and they're not going to find the solution that way.
No, they're not.
If they don't, and the reason why is because they don't go back far enough in history. See where early childhood, like I said, I was on LinkedIn the other day, and somebody was mentioning about this concept of pre-K. And I posted it, and I said, or as they used to call it, kindergarten, because kindergarten was from age 3 to 7.
Uh-huh.
Right? It wasn't 5-year-olds. And what they're saying is, well, you need to start with 3-year-olds. Well, that's what kindergarten was originally.
Right.
But see, nobody knows that, and so they keep calling something pre-kindergarten, when kindergarten really was intended to be an ungraded range between 3 and 7.
They keep calling it preschool. You know, in order for people to understand, because when you say kindergarten, they definitely think K, you know, those 5-6-year-olds. And so, you know, but if you're a Montessori person, of course, you know that it starts at 3. But, you know, that's a communication thing. It's like when they say best practices in public school, and I tell them, well, you know, you're talking about is what Montessori called normalized. She didn't mean, oh, you've taken the child and pounded him into something normal. It means that the child is directing themselves.
Sure. Well, but so here's the other thing about this. Been so over the last 15 years, I've had a lot of opportunity. I've spoken at Montessori conferences, for instance. I've been to the NAYC and the ACI and all these different places. And I find there's just as much ignorance on the other side of the coin. You know, people would come up to me after my talk at the Montessori conferences, and they would say, you know, I always knew she got that information from somewhere, because Feubel was doing exactly what she was doing 60 years before she was.
Uh-huh.
He was doing it before, he died before she was even born. You know, and that's the thing, is people don't know that there existed a Montessori-like approach before Montessori did her thing. And John Taylor Gatto, who's behind the unschooling movement, you know, he was under the impression that Feubel was part of this whole Germanic, you know, fascist school. We want to take the children away from the mothers and put them in this, you know, government-run facility. And that couldn't have been further from the truth. Feubel had meetings for mothers, and he said, you are the first and best teacher of your child. Let me show you things that you can do at home to work with your child. Trust your instincts. You know more than you think. So Feubel schools in Germany, they were not like, you know, these prison-like structures that we have here where the child is forced to leave their mother and go there. In Germany, Feubel schools were a community. It was like almost like a commune, where the parents were there working side by side with the teachers. But John Taylor Gatto can write in his book, you know, that Feubel was part of this fascist German approach to education, and people will read it and go, oh, well, John Taylor Gatto knows what he's talking about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I'm not...
He never did his research.
No, he never did, and I have a... I'm not an unschooler myself. I really do believe that there is no freedom without limits. Freedom without limits is called license. And children want limits. They don't...
Well, but so what I see in the unschool movement is something very similar to what Feubel did, which is why I would have thought that Gatto would have been totally on board with Feubel. Feubel would take children out and they would work on projects. He would involve them in the life of the community. So they might build a structure if they needed to build a barn. But he would use that needing to build the barn to, you know, talk about geometry, to talk, you know, all these different, you know, science and all the things that were related. And you see that a lot with unschoolers, is their children really get deep into life before a lot of other children do that are in school. They're working on real world projects.
Right. It's a project centered. I understand. I'm just telling you the philosophy of this person I find questionable. And I want you to know that in my Montessori training, which was American Montessori Society, Joy Turner, and I knew the Feubel was before Montessori, and I knew that he was an inspiration. And I feel like really what Montessori did then by developing, you know, some of her own materials and with these children that everyone had given up on is, you know, that they were supposedly retarded. She showed that that wasn't the case, that it was a matter of lack of stimulation. And so although she did develop, you know, some materials, she just knew that Feubel was right, that the activity, you know, was how the brain developed, the hand, that's how it developed. I don't think she would have wanted to say, I'm the first one to think of this. But
she gave credit to Feubel, and so that, you know, that's the thing about it, that, you know, the AMS was the conference that I was at, and she spoke about Feubel in her speeches. You know, she, as a medical doctor, was given the task of working with these at-risk children, and so she was adapting Feubel to fit the environment, to fit, you know, the group of children that she was working with, and she innovated amazing amounts of things. So I take nothing away from her work whatsoever.
I know.
It wasn't that she copied Feubel. That was the only early childhood system at the time. She was simply adapting and refining and expanding and doing all these wonderful things. But that in some circles, and I don't know if it's AMI or other, you know, that they're not talking as much. But the E.M. Standing biography on Montessori, within the first 8 to 10 pages, has had a discussion about the Feubel influence that Maria acknowledged, and Rudolf Steiner acknowledged the impact that Feubel had on his work.
Yes.
So there's a lot of this stuff out there that, you know, I just think it's not about necessarily giving credit to Froebel. Everybody gets credit for what they did. Even Froebel himself gave credit to Pestalozzi and to all the different people that inspired him. I think the most important thing about the history is that we understand how and why all of this stuff occurred. Because another person came up at the Montessori conference, and she said, I found this very interesting because I thought that Montessori was rejected because she was a woman or because she was Catholic. And I said, you know, I wouldn't rule those out. I'm sure they had an influence. But it was clear that the reason why they rejected Montessori was that the Froebelians thought she wasn't Froebelian enough, and the ones that were anti-Froebel thought she was too much like Froebel. She didn't even have a fair shot at it, you know. So, and that's really why I say I think the history is important to get an understanding of what the real factors were at the time.
It is, and especially if you can get this this film that you're making, this documentary, if you can get it to places like poverty, where people live in poverty, if you can get it to those parents, if you can get it to those teachers, if you can get it into those schools, that would be fantastic. You know, there's a whole opt-out movement that parents started at Opt Out International, where parents opt their children out of the testing. And it's really gaining momentum. And it's because these parents are learning, you know, about how important it is that their child move, that their child have choices. That they're, you know.
You're right, and a lot of teachers, I really applaud them for refusing to do the testing and
administer.
And,
yeah,
you know, it's the boycott, I think, that needs to happen, because it will force the people that are designing these management processes to try to come up with something that is more effective.
And that's positive.
But here's one of the reasons why I decided to do this film. Was that in 2007, I was at the International Froebel Society conference at Wheelock in Boston. And it was a fascinating group of people. There was probably only 70 or 80 of us in this room. But it was David Elkind, it was Diane Levin, it was Diane Ravitch, it was Nancy Carlson Page, Dorothy Hughes, who was my mentor, she was there. There were just a lot of very well-known, very effective people in the early childhood community. Edgar Klugman was there. I mean, I could name all these people, but the best of the best was in that room. And every one of them, in turn, got up and bemoaned the lack of play, the lack of outdoor access, you know, all the things that we've been talking about so far today. And I stood up and I said, well, you know, you're preaching to the choir here. We know that, and we know that you know that, and we know that you have all the research to support it. So I guess the question is, why isn't anybody listening to this, right? Why aren't the governments changing? And it was like, I can't tell you how many blank faces there were in that room. They were all as frustrated as I was that people were not listening. And so I feel like this film has the opportunity. A lot of those people are people that are going to be interviewed for the film. Some of them are actually supporting the film financially.
Great.
They feel that we need to tell this story, to rally around the story as an effective way of discussing what the actual problem is today. It's not about simply documenting the history. But again, my reason for wanting to do it right away is Dorothy Hughes has passed away. Edgar Klugman is quite ill. There are all these different people that we need to, Bud Spodek is quite ill. These are people who have been championing play-based child-centered education for 50 or more years, and they're not going to be with us that much longer. We need to get their testimony on video.
Are you going to talk to William Crane?
Well, again, one of the things I need to determine is with this project, and it's one of the reasons why I selected Kickstarter. I mean, there were different ways I could have gone. But Kickstarter is not a closed crowdfunding. So once you reach the goal, you can go beyond the goal. And so what I will have to determine is, given the amount of money that we've raised, how many people can I effectively interview for that? And luckily, a lot of people are in Boston. Maybe you know, 10 or 11 of the people that I want to interview are in Boston, that's going to make it incredibly efficient for me to get those interviews.
Yes.
But if I have to travel, you know, to Seattle and down to Miami and go to Dallas, and then the costs really add up. So to answer your question, I don't know who and how many I'm going to be able to get. It's all going to come down to how much we're able to raise.
Well, his textbook, you know, his textbook, Theories of Development, is, you know, it's kind of like the Bible in teacher training.
Sure, sure.
And he keeps updating it and really includes everyone. He was my first guest on Education Now, and I think he's great, if you can get him. And I have had Alkind on as well, and I really enjoyed Alkind. And also, many others, including yourself, way back in 2000.
I appreciate you having me back today. My goal is to try to get the word out. I know this is not a project that everybody will support, and I understand that, but I feel that it's, of all the things that I can do with my research, my knowledge of Froebel, making this film that can be used in the universities for the teacher training and that can also inform the debate, I don't think there's anything more important that I can do at this time. And again, one of my very top priorities is to try to capture these interviews. I had the luck of being able to get Dorothy Hughes to sit down for a couple of hours, and we captured that on video. I've made that available at my FroebelUSA.org website for those people that know of Dorothy. But otherwise, you know, she'd written some papers and she'd written some other things, but to hear her, to see her and the passion that she had, that's what I'm trying to do with this film.
That's wonderful. I think it's wonderful. And mention, give us the address again so the listeners hear it loud and clear from you for the website.
If you go to FroebelUSA.org, so it's FroebelUSA.org, not only will you be able to click the link and see the Dorothy Hughes video, which was done 15 years ago, so the quality isn't as it is today. It's not high definition or anything, but there's also a link there for the Kickstarter. You can also go to Kickstarter and search for Froebel, and you will find, or search for kindergarten, and you will find our project. I believe we only have another maybe 11 or 12 days before our time is up. The clock is ticking on us.
Mm-hmm.
It's an all or nothing situation. We have to raise about another $10,000. We have 11 days to do it. If we don't reach that amount in that time, then we get nothing. I'm not sure exactly what we'll do at that point, but one of the advantages, if we do reach this goal and we get the funding that we need to make this 15-minute video, is that we will then be able to submit it to normal funding sources. There are a lot of foundations that have grants, and then we will be able to extend the length of the video, and we will have these interviews. We will have hours and hours of interviews that we can use to expand it to a much wider range. And so that's really what we're looking at this point.
Well, I'm very excited about it, and I know other Montessori people are very excited about it and have been spreading the word. I think it was one of the more popular things that I posted on the Education Now Facebook page. Was the little blurb that you made, the little video you made about this Kickstarter. So I'm hopeful. How much do you have now?
We're a little over 9,100, so we're not quite halfway there. And it's, you know, it's, I've done Kickstarters before, successful Kickstarters. It takes a lot of communication. You really have to email people every day, all day. But I have been noticing people who I don't know. I don't know who they are. I didn't contact them directly, so I'm imagining that they're coming through your website. And that's really what I'm looking for is when I do contact people, what I say is, you know, I hope you'll support our project. But even if you don't, what's most important for me is that you think about who might be willing to support it, because I don't know everybody that I need to know. And so for me, one of the great benefits of doing this project, I'm not being compensated in any way. I'm not doing it for my own benefit. I happen to have this research. I'm in a position to be able to do it. But what I am benefiting from is I'm finding new people out there that I hadn't known were out there. And so this networking process for Kickstarter has been really wonderful for me. I've made a lot of new friends. And so that's what I'm saying to people is even if you're not able to contribute, I would really like to hear from you, and I'd like to hear from anybody that you think I should contact about the project, because it's a huge benefit to network to find like-minded people that are out there.
Yes, it is. You have a passion for it, and that's what's needed. And I want you know, it was only on the Education Now Facebook page in my own wall, and it got quite a bit of attention. Now it will be on the website, and it will also go out to a huge emailing and lists that I have, and pages, as well as the Facebook page and the Google Plus page. And so and I'm going to post it on some teacher pages as well. And so I'm just going to hope that we get a big push and that it goes a flying, Scott. I really do. Also, I'm going to post it, I think, on the Public Montessori Education website. The Facebook page. They have a Facebook page, Public Montessori School, you know, because they got a big grant to help start some public Montessori schools like you have there in Michigan. And I want to see that it gets onto that page too, because maybe you'll get something from there. I wish you every bit of luck, and mostly I want it for the children, and I want this news to get to the kids who, and the teachers and the communities that really need to hear it. And I'm just so pleased to support it.
Well, I can't thank you enough. You were so wonderful the last time you'd interviewed me and helping to kind of keep this word about Froebel out there and in front of people. As I said, I sent my children to Montessori, so I have a great fondness for Montessori. I also know that over the years, the Montessori teachers and schools have really supported the work that I've done and made use of it. And so I appreciate all that you do to help me to get the word out there.
Well, it's important what you're doing, and we didn't tell the audience how the kindergarten had impacted American culture through like architecture. You want to go into that? How was it that influenced Frank Lloyd Wright and Buckminster Fuller and others?
Well, it's interesting how many different ways. For instance, the one that people are the most surprised about is that they don't realize that the song Happy Birthday was originally Good Morning to You. It was a welcome song for the Froebel Kindergarten, because every morning you would welcome the children in and they would sit. It was this morning circle that Froebel mm-hmm. developed. And so they would sing Good Morning to You every morning. And then on special days when a child would have a birthday, they would change the words to Happy Birthday to You. And one of the parents of the children heard the song and thought it would be make a wonderful addition to a Broadway show. And so they licensed the song from the sisters that wrote it, and the rest is history. And so today we all know this song, Happy Birthday. We just don't know that it came from the Froebel Kindergarten.
Isn't that beautiful?
So, yeah. It's really the impact that kindergarten is. Obviously the impact on modern art and design and the careers of Frank Lloyd Wright and Buckminster Fuller and Charles Eames, but even in the other fields too. That's, you know, Inventing Kindergarten is a book that we've republished. It was one of the successful Kickstarters that we did a year or two ago to bring that book back, and that talks about the impact of kindergarten on modern art and architecture. But there were other fields as well. So, for instance, Richard Feynman, the physicist, he had a Froebel education as a child, and so. There's a huge impact on the culture. The woman that played the Wicked Witch of the West in The Wizard of Oz,
yeah.
Margaret, I can't think of her last name, uh-huh. but she was a Froebel-trained teacher.
Uh-huh.
And it's a kind of an interesting thing, because she plays this woman that's scary to children, and yet here was somebody that was a highly trained observer of children and worked with young children. And the Hull House, for instance, the settlement houses, the YMCA movement. There was a William Heilman was a Froebel, was one of the great people in the Froebel kindergarten movement. He was appointed the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and one of his plans was to make Froebel education available to Native Americans. And when other parts of the government found out that that's what he was going to do, they removed him from that post.
Right, because you don't want educated, you know, and not only, I mean, really their own education. I worked with a Native American community here locally for a while. It was so awesome to hear the gentleman say, "This is our school," and he's, you know, pointing to the outdoors, you know. This is the school.
Right.
And like, it's not in a room, right? This is the school.
Well, that's what Heilman was observing. He was realizing that Native Americans had the same reverence for nature that Froebel had.
And yes.
That it was something that was in alignment with their own values.
Right.
And that if they were going to use any kind of education to sort of... And again, one of the... Claire Gallagher is a woman that I met in the last few weeks who has done some amazing research into the use of the Froebel kindergarten on Ellis Island to acclimate immigrant children to U.S. culture. And she's written a chapter, I think it was James Martin is the author. He's an editor, and he brought together a bunch of researchers like Claire. And so there's all these bits of stories that are out there, different people researching different aspects of this. And that's why, for me, in doing this film, I'm really interviewing people like Claire, interviewing people that have knowledge of, you know, these parts of our culture that were impacted by Froebel kindergarten. That's really my role, is to work as an editor and bring it all together.
Bring the history as well as the ideas. It's
Absolutely.
It's a beautiful, and I just hope it goes sailing, as I said. I'm really looking forward to it, to its taking off. And you have as well as the Froebel USA, website, you have the Froebel USA Facebook page.
Yes.
Right?
Yep. And we're on Twitter. We try to connect with people in the way that they like to be connected.
Uh-huh. So you're on Twitter, and do you want to give out your hashtag?
Well, it's Froebel USA. It's pretty simple. Froebel USA, at Froebel USA on Twitter. And then if you go to Facebook, it's facebook.com/FroebelUSA.
Right.
So it's pretty simple to find us. You can Google us. And you know, I think we have Tumblr and Pinterest and a lot of these other ones, too. But I think the bulk of what we do goes out over Facebook and Twitter.
Yeah.
And we're putting content up usually, you know, 2-3 times a week. And really sharing, you know, not just about Froebel, but sharing, like you had mentioned, some of these parents rebelling against standardized testing, the teachers rebelling. It all sort of works together.
Right. Seattle is where the parents in Seattle, the teachers in Seattle are the ones that are picking up the stick. I'm so proud of them. And in Chicago, it's the union. And so, you know, those two places are pretty active, but now in New Jersey, it's the parents. And so it's exciting for me to see, people taking action, because I think that's the only way it's going to change. And that's why I feel like this is so important, because this gives them something to take with them, to show, to, you know, it's important. Planned Parenthood can run this, you know, this video. That would be an excellent way to share it. So thanks again, Scott, for being my guest for this June edition, and for being who you are.
Oh, well, thank you so much. I really appreciate all the encouragement over the years and giving me the ability to reach your audience and to share what I'm doing with Froebel.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Talk to you soon.
Okay. Thank you, Athena.
Bye-bye.
must have a code that you can live by, and so become yourself, because the past is just a goodbye. Teach your children well. Their father's hell did slowly go by, and feed them on your dreams, the one they picked, the one you know.